Let's call this meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:30 PM on Monday, February 9th, 2026. Before we begin, I want to thank Juliana Singh, the Senate Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Susan Quigley from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Senator Tilton, Senator Tobin, and myself, Senator Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business, and we also have Senator Stevens. We still have a quorum to conduct business. The first and only item on our agenda today is House Bill 101, Crimes Against Minors, Age of Consent, sponsored by Representative Gray. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Here to present the bill is Representative Gray and his staff, Dylan Hitchcock-Lopez. Available for questions as well as Angie Kemp from the Department of Law, the Deputy Attorney General, Brenda Stanfield from the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, and we have two folks who will be providing invited testimony as well. So Representative Gray, Mr. Hitchcock-Lopez, you don't need to come forward because you're already there. Please put yourselves on the record. You may begin your presentations. I will note it's generally our practice that if people have questions in the midst of your presentation, they can ask. I'm also going to ask that we hold most of our questions till after the invited testimony. Please proceed.
Thank you so much, Chair Klayman and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Andrew Gray. I represent the UMed District in Anchorage. Alaska has the highest rate of rape in the country, which is over three times the national average. We also have one of the highest rates of child sexual assault in the country, nearly six times the national average, according to the UAA Justice Center's Alaska Victimization Survey. Advocates from Alaska's domestic violence and sexual assault organizations have identified Alaska's low age of sexual consent as a unique risk factor for the sexual assault of minors aged 16 or 17, and that is the reason for this bill. The goal is to reduce the amount of rape and sexual assault affecting Alaska's young people. HB 101 does this by raising the age of sexual consent from 16 to 18. Under current statute, 16 and 17-year-old individuals can legally consent to sex with an adult of any age. In the case of a sexual assault, therefore, these minors must prove that they did not consent to sex in court, which makes the successful prosecution of cases such as this difficult, especially when alcohol or drugs are present, as they often are. An example, in late December 2023 in Soldotna, a 63-year-old law enforcement officer by the name of Vince Peronto was sentenced to 8 years in prison for attempted sexual abuse of a minor in the second degree. In 2018, he had pulled over a 16-year-old. Pause for 1 second. I feel like the microphone's going in and out. Is that just me? It's me. Good. Sorry. Thank you. In 2018, he had pulled over a 16-year-old female while driving, then started exchanging flirtatious text messages with her. When her father found out, he contacted law enforcement and they set up a sting operation to catch him attempting to meet her for sex. The only reason this was considered criminal is because he was an officer and was thus in a position of authority, which is already a crime. If he hadn't been with law enforcement, if he had just been, say, a friend of her father, or anyone else not in a position of authority, it would have been perfectly legal for that 63-year-old to meet up with that 16-year-old for sex. In Alaska, a 16 or 17-year-old cannot legally enter into a contract, sign a lease, join the military, or even get a tattoo. But under Alaska law, that same 16 or 17-year-old can, on their own, with no parental involvement whatsoever, choose to have sex with a 63-year-old. Crisis hotlines routinely receive calls from parents who report their teenage child being manipulated by an older adult into a sexual relationship. If that child is 16 or 17, there is no legal recourse for that parent. They have no say. House Bill 101 closes the age of consent, increases the age of consent to 18, closing this loophole that has left 16 and 17-year-old children unprotected from predators. A close-in-age exemption is present in this bill. This Romeo and Juliet clause, as it's often called, allows for a 16 or 17-year-old to legally consent to sex with someone around their same age. The intent of this bill is not to criminalize consensual sex among teenagers. The goal is to make it more difficult for 16 and 17-year-olds to be the victims of sexual assault, something that we know is a prevalent problem in our state. According to the CDC's 2023 Youth Risk Behavior Surveillance, youth who were forced to engage in sexual acts by an adult at least 5 years older than them reported significantly higher rates of high-risk behaviors and adverse mental health outcomes, such as substance use, depressive symptoms, and suicidal ideation. Alaska's most recent data, according to our Alaska Youth Behavior Survey from 2023, did not ask explicitly about age gap relationships, but it did show that 30% of high school students were sexually active, with 57.8% of Alaska high school seniors reporting that they had had sex, with 15% of females and 5% of males reporting sexual dating violence, and 8.6% of all students reporting that they had been physically forced to have sexual intercourse. Throughout my several years of carrying this policy, I have encountered surprise from everyday Alaskans. They had assumed that the age of consent was 18. Do you know who absolutely knows that our age of consent is 16? Predators. And those predators will know when we change this, when we change that law. And therefore, they would face severe consequences if they continued to target our 16 and 17-year-olds. HB 101 also makes changes for consistency in several other areas of criminal statute that treat 16 and 17-year-olds differently than other minors, such as criminalizing the sending of explicit images of 16 and 17-year-olds. Currently, sending photos of nude 16 and 17-year-olds is not a crime, but it should be. What these additional changes do, and this is why the bill is so long, is make our statutes consistent. A minor would truly be anyone under the age of 18, period. If we pass House Bill 101, Alaska would have the same age of consent as California, Florida, Tennessee, Utah, Oregon, Arizona, Virginia, Wyoming, Wisconsin, and North Dakota. I will now turn to my staff, Dylan Hitchcock Lopez, who will walk you through the sectional analysis if it pleases the committee, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hitchcock Lopez, please proceed.
Good afternoon. For the record, Dylan Hitchcock Lopez, staff to Representative Gray. So as to the chair and the committee at large, as Representative Gray said, the point of the bill is to raise the age of consent from 16 to 18. Age of consent is, in Alaska law, found in sort of a constellation of statutes. So sections 1 through 6 of the bill amend multiple statutes to update the definition of a minor, raising the age from 16 to 18 in cases related to specific criminal offenses. Section 7 of the bill amends the crime of sexual abuse of a minor in the first degree to provide that an offender 18 years of age or older commits the offense if they engage in sexual penetration with a person under 18 years of age over whom they have authority and who is at least 2 years younger than the offender. Section 8 amends the crime of sexual abuse of a minor in the second degree to provide that an offender commits the offense if they engage in sexual penetration with a person who is 16 or 17 and at least 6 years younger than the offender. Section 9 amends the crime of sexual abuse of a minor in the third degree by providing that an offender commits the offense if they engage in sexual contact with a person who is 16 or 17 and at least 6 years younger than the offender. Sections 10 through 27 modify various statutes to update the legal definition of a minor. They change the age threshold from 16 to 18 years old for crimes related to child endangerment, indecent exposure, solicitation, and also make relevant amendments to the sentencing guidelines. Section 30 lists the statutes repealed. Section 31 clarifies applicability, and Section 32 provides for an effective date.
All right, thank you very much. What I'm going to suggest we do is we hold off on questions for the bill sponsor and others in the audience until after we have heard invited testimony. Today we have two folks here for invited testimony. I think they're here. The first one is Randy Brager, the Executive Director of Abused Women's Aid in Crisis. Ms. Brager, are you on the line with us?
Yes, Chairman, I'm here.
All right, if you would identify yourself for the record, make sure you're not on a speakerphone, and you can begin your remarks.
Excellent, thank you. For the record, my name is Randy Brager, and I serve as the Executive Director of AWAKE. AWAKE is a nonprofit based in Anchorage dedicated to supporting domestic violence victims and other victims of violent crime, advocating for policy change, and strengthening systems that protect survivors. I am here to support House Bill 101 and feel it's a critical step to ensuring that our legal system adequately protects minors from sexual abuse and related offenses. With nearly 20 years of leadership experience in nonprofit, advocacy, and government sectors, I have seen firsthand the profound impacts of domestic violence and sexual abuse on individuals, families, and communities across Alaska. Working for the Department of Public Safety for nearly a decade also gave me a unique perspective of the immense challenges our state has in providing justice for victims of these crimes. You are already aware that Alaska consistently reports some of the highest rates of sexual violence in the country, and this crisis is exacerbated by many systemic gaps, including protection for minors who lack the legal safeguards necessary to ensure justice. The way our laws are currently written, we have drawn an arbitrary line that is not supported by what we know scientifically about teens' cognitive, emotional, and physical social development. We have determined that a 15-year-old child is not developmentally equipped to enter into a sexual relationship with a middle-aged man. This legislation is proposing that something profound or magical does not, in fact, occur a day after they turn 16. And yes, I understand the perpetrator could be a middle-aged woman. I am just illustrating this using statistically predominant examples. While working at Covenant House in my previous role, we witnessed day in and day out vulnerable teenagers who can legally consent be picked up by older men. When I say older men, I mean men in their 40s, 50s, 60s. Men these teenagers identified as their boyfriends. Men we knew were preying on vulnerable children who were experiencing homelessness and often trauma from previous assaults, abuse, mental health issues, and vulnerabilities caused by substance use. This common sense bill tells us that these adults do not in fact believe they are engaging in a meaningful relationship with someone they consider a peer or an equal. They are simply being predatory and taking advantage of children. While relatively few of these cases cross the paths of law enforcement, I can tell you this is not happening infrequently. These vulnerable teenagers are seeking supports from agencies such as Covenant House due to stigma and because previous experience tells them law enforcement cannot assist them. When discussing consent, there are also often concerns about what is sometimes referenced as Romeo and Juliet relationships, these high school relationships. Concerns about criminalizing relationships between peers have been brought up, and their statistics do not support that concern, statistics that Department of Law would have available for review. It is important to know that the data we are asking for and what we are comparing it to. If law enforcement has high estimates for cases increases due to this bill, Department of Law demonstrates very low rates of conviction in quote-unquote Romeo and Juliet scenarios. This demonstrates effective screening and negates the misdirection of focusing our concerns of convincing peers in mutual relationships. Those are simply not the relationships we're discussing today. This bill would also reduce the burden on law enforcement and prosecutors to hold these adult predators accountable. Under the current law, investigators must devote significant time and resources to proving that sexual acts against 16 and 17-year-olds were non-consensual. In other words, they must meet the legal definition of rape. In these cases, many of these cases, adults supply minors with alcohol or drugs and engage in sex with them. Proving that teenager was incapacitated and therefore legally unable to consent is extremely difficult, even with the facts strongly suggest exploitation. We know incapacitation cases are amongst the hardest sexual assault cases to successfully investigate and prosecute anyway. At the same time, sexual violence is already the most unreported crime. Of the cases that are reported to law enforcement, only a small fraction result in charges, and an even smaller fraction results in convictions. That attrition from police report to conviction leads to conviction rates being in the single digits in Alaska. When the legal framework itself requires proving incapacitation or support in situations involving minors, it further compounds that attrition. I understand there are significant fiscal concerns in our state. However, if estimates suggest the number of impacted cases could be substantial, that should concern us even more, not less. A high number of cases would signal a deeper cultural problem with sex and rape with children. Passing HB 101 sends a clear message that Alaska prioritizes the safety of its children and will not tolerate behaviors that devastate lives. Thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Brager? Ms. Brager, I do have one question. You described in your work at Covenant House seeing primarily men in their 40s, 50s, and 60s preying on teenage girls. What about men in their 20s and 30s? Was that 20s and 30s a prevalent, something you saw any prevalence, or is it primarily men in their 40s, 50s, and 60s?
We saw all age spans. I just know that a lot of the focus of the conversation gets focused on people in their early 20s, and that was not what we were predominantly seeing. We were predominantly seeing much older individuals, whether they've been in their 30s or 40s, but then also many individuals that were clearly in their 50s and 60s.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions. Next in invited testimony, we have Keely Olson, Executive Director, Standing Together Against Rape. Ms. Olson, if you want to please identify yourself for the record and make sure you're not on a speakerphone. But before you do that, I want to recognize that Representative Jubilee Underwood has joined us in the audience today. Welcome to the Senate Judiciary today. And Ms. Olson.
Good afternoon. My name is Keely Olson, and I am the Executive Director of STAR in Anchorage. I am testifying in support of HB 101, raising the age of consent to sexual acts for minors from the age of 16 to 18. Thank you to the bill's sponsor, Representative Gray, and thanks to all on the Senate Judiciary Committee for allowing me to speak with you today. STAR sees firsthand the damage sustained by youth who are groomed and sexually abused by predatory adults. STAR advocates respond to every emergent report of sexual assault in the municipality of Anchorage as part of the sexual assault response team. We also respond in person with Special Victims Unit detectives to support individuals detailing incidents of past abuse. Many people who elect not to report to law enforcement disclose the harm they have suffered directly to STAR advocates. STAR goes on to provide advocacy, support, safety planning, information about victims' rights, court accompaniment, assistance accessing restitution and victims' compensation, systems advocacy, access to pro bono civil attorneys, and trauma therapy. We are in a unique position to inform the legislature of the grave harm that sexual abuse of minors causes in the lives of Alaskans. In this age of national and worldwide demand for the release of the Epstein files and accountability for those responsible, it is quite apparent the majority of adults agree that minors need to be protected from predatory adults, and the public at large cares immensely about protecting youth from harm. It is crucial to note that most of the women who have come forward publicly as victims of Jeffrey Epstein were 16 or 17-year-old girls at the onset of the abuse. While Epstein was able to repeatedly escape accountability due to wealth and powerful connections, at the very least, the abuse was considered criminal and prompted investigations of human trafficking. We cannot be sure the same would have occurred in Alaska due to the state's age of consent. It can be difficult to quantify how many youths this may affect. I provided several examples to Representative Gray as we discussed this bill. The clearest one I can provide to you today is that of a former legislative aide, Benjamin Anderson Agamuk, who in 2020, at the age of 27, was charged in Bethel with two counts of furnishing alcohol to a person under 21 and one count of sexual assault of a minor under the age of 13. The details leading up to the sexual assault of an 11-year-old girl are disturbing, yet clearly illustrate the way current law fails teens and jeopardizes our state's most vulnerable residents. His charges resulted from an incident that was the second time in a month the police had responded to claims the suspect had sex with a minor after furnishing them with alcohol. The first incident, according to court documents, police responded to a call on March 5th, 2020, of a juvenile girl passed out on the street. When officers arrived, the 16-year-old girl's mother said the suspect gave her daughter alcohol and then had sex with her without consent. According to the police affidavit, Anderson Azima responded to questioning by police, saying that even if he did have sex with her, she was 16, so it was legal. While he was detained, police applied for a warrant to collect DNA evidence. While waiting for that warrant, the suspect's attorney demanded his release, and police complied. They were unable to locate him after the warrant came through. The second incident, less than 1 month later, on April 2nd, 2020, the charges say that police responded to a 911 call reporting a 14-year-old girl and an 11-year-old girl lying on the ground in front of the Kuskokwim Consortium Library. According to the charging document, the 11-year-old told police she had been raped by the suspect. The girl said he had gotten her and the 14-year-old drunk and high on cannabis. The 11-year-old told police she had been able to protect the 14-year-old from being raped as well. Police located the suspect and arrested him the same day. His bail was set at $50,000. In 2023, he pled guilty and was sentenced to 36 years in prison. Note that he was never held accountable for the alleged rape of the 16-year-old a few weeks earlier. And in fact, the only charge he faced for that incident was furnishing alcohol to a minor. Overcoming the consent defense was too high a burden for the state to provide or to prove with a teen under the influence of alcohol furnished by the predator. I believe this case clearly illustrates the difference in the handling of rape allegations involving the same conduct, the only difference being the minors were above and below 16 years of age. In this case, the handling of the 16-year-old's case allowed the offender to go free and brazenly escalate his predatory attacks on children. All of us share a responsibility to protect youth in Alaska from predatory adults. STAR and its board and its staff urge you to promptly pass HB 101. Thank you for your attention and time to this matter. I will remain on the line in case of any questions.
Does anyone have any questions for Ms. Olson? Hearing and seeing none, thank you very much. Next, are there questions from the committee members for the bill sponsor, his staff, or any other folks here in the audience? Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Gray, you mentioned several different studies, and I was looking on BASIS, and I didn't see them uploaded to the bill packet. I'm hoping you might be able to share those with us and the public.
Thank you, Senator Tobin. Through the chair, Senator Tobin, yes, we will share them.
Senator Gray, our staff, I actually am a little not sure who said it, but there was a suggestion that the Department of Law has statistics about what would happen if we raised the age of consent and how many cases there would be. And is that something that the Department of Law provided you all?
To Chair Klayman, I believe that was Ms. Brager.
Okay. We can ask Department of Law. Second question, specific to the age of consent. You've got another bill, House Bill 36, that in other circumstances lowers the age of consent. Can you explain one bill that you're seeking to lower the age of consent, whereas this bill you're seeking to raise the age of consent, and how those interplay?
Thank you so much for the question, Chair Klayman. As you remember, it was in your committee that you created a CS that added Senator Giesel's bill that lowers the age of consent. My House Bill 36 prevents foster children from being held in an acute psychiatric facility as a foster placement.
Your bill now includes the provisions of Senator Giesel's bill. So I'm asking you because I'm working on the belief it is your bill as well.
Thank you so much, Senator Klayman. So the goal of both bills is to protect 16 and 17-year-olds. The goal of both bills is to provide as much help that we can to our young people. So in the case of Senator Giesel's bill that has been amended into mine.
You mean your bill?
Excuse me, Chair Klayman. In my bill, this new amendment as provided by, I'm sorry, I'm going to say it, and I know it'll be a point of order, but I'm going to call it Senator Giesel's because it's really her idea and she's championed it for a long time, and I'm so sorry. But that bill wants to provide our most vulnerable youth with the opportunity to seek mental health care of their own volition, up to 5 visits. And I believe that that's consistent with wanting to protect 16 and 17-year-olds from rape and sexual assault. The folks who are most vulnerable to predators are those who are experiencing insecure housing, insecure food, who might be in a home where there's abuse. And those are the folks who are vulnerable to predators and most likely to be sexually assaulted. Those are the same folks who would benefit most from the mental health care supplied by that portion of House Bill 36.
Okay, so just you've got a lot in your going. Let's focus on just specifics about House Bill 36. Do you fully support the effort to lower the age of consent for getting mental health care?
Senator Klayman, I 100% support that because it allows our 16 and 17-year-olds to have the most resources possible.
Okay. And I completely agree, and I support that bill. And so I'm just trying for the audience that may not know as much about House Bill 36. Your distinction between the two is that for a person that's 16 or 17, even though they may lack the ability to enter any other relationships as a 16 or 17-year-old, you believe those folks should, in fact, be able to make their own decision to get mental health care.
Thank you. To the chair, I believe that youth of lots of ages benefit from mental health care. I think that through hearings that have happened in this body and in our body, we know that there are certain youth, particularly if they're in an abusive household, where getting parental permission to seek mental health care could be challenging. So that's a very limited opportunity for the child to seek mental health care if they're 16 or 17 years old. Again, I believe it's 100% consistent with my bill, with wanting to protect 16 and 17-year-olds.
So now the next question is, how do you, tell me again, distinguish now a person who's not a situation who's seeking mental health care and may have difficulty getting parental consent for that mental health care, even though you and I both agree that that's appropriate. How do you distinguish the situation here where you're raising the age of consent for the same group of people?
Thank you so much for that question. What we know in Alaska is when it comes to sex trafficking, the most common instance of sex trafficking is a parent sex trafficking their own child. A parent who has sex trafficked their own child may decline from giving consent to that 16 or 17-year-old to get mental health care where they may discuss the crime that their parent has submitted them to. So what this does is provide an opportunity for that child to report the criminal neglect and criminal actions that their parents may have taken. That person that they're reporting to would be a mandated reporter. This gives an opportunity for law enforcement to intervene on behalf of the 16 or 17-year-old. So really, this is a wonderful tool when applied to House Bill 101 to ensure that when folks are being raped, that they are able to bring that that crime forward and get law enforcement to involved.
And I just want to track that I'm listening accurately. You're saying the highest incidence of sexual abuse of a minor is by parents?
No, sir.
Okay, I may have misunderstood.
The word I used was sex trafficking.
Okay. Representative Gray, I know you've got it helps if you'll wait till a question gets finished before you start answering. Can you do that?
Thank you. Through the chair, to the chair. I will wait and I'll be very patient. Please give your question.
So restate the information you just said about sex trafficking, because I don't ever recall having heard that statistic before.
So thank you to the chair. Thank you for, I apologize for not waiting for you to complete your questions. I know that's frustrating.
It isn't frustrating to me. It's just you're actually undermining your own presentation when you get impatient.
Thank
I'm
you,
more
sir.
Than happy to go through this process and whatever process we need to do. But go ahead and talk about the sex trafficking.
So I've served on House Judiciary. I'm now in my 4th year. And during Sarah Vance's chairmanship, when I was in the minority, we had a very long, a series of hearings on sex trafficking. And so we had some organizations come and present. One organization that presented, and I can't recall their name off the top of my head, but I will get it for you, presented about the risk factors of being sex trafficked. And the primary risk factor for sex trafficking is poverty. folks who are in extreme poverty are the most likely to be sex trafficked. And I think that there is a Hollywood version of sex trafficking that involves a perhaps a criminal cartel coming in and running a sex trafficking ring. But in most instances, it's really one child being sex trafficked. And most often, the person who's aiding in that sex trafficking is the parent. And that was from an organization that presented in House Judiciary when I was in the minority. So I will go and find that information for you. But that is the most common reason that someone is sex trafficked is because they are in abject poverty. And it happens from the family.
And do you remember the organization that presented that information?
I'm so sorry. I can't recall, but I will find that for you.
And do you recall at those hearings if the Department of Law or the Department of Public Safety ever testified and provided those similar statistics?
I don't recall. Thank you for the question, Mr. Chair.
I don't believe I have any other questions for the bill sponsor or his staff. Any other questions for the bill sponsor or his staff? I have some questions for Ms. Kemp. Nope. Oh, just as a note, Ms. Kemp, you can come forward. There are a number of fiscal notes on this bill, and I think there was some confusion on my part with what I asked my office to get to everyone on the committee. So we're going to actually not discuss fiscal notes today. We will take that up at a future hearing, and I'll make sure that we get you on the committee the full collection of fiscal notes for us to review. The reason I have particular interest in the fiscal notes is we've seen a significant reduction of the fiscal notes from when the bill was first introduced. I think that although we are not the Finance Committee, I think we should take a careful look. So Ms. Kemp, the area that I had some questions about, every year on statute, Department of Law provides the sex offense cases report. I've got the most recent version, which I think covers July 23 through June 24. And I know you and I have talked about it before, but it shows that there's a large number of sex cases that are not prosecuted. They get screened in, but I think over 50% are not prosecuted. And so my question is, if this bill is passed, what is likely to happen to the number of case referrals that come to the Department of Law, and what's likely to happen with, if you can predict that, what's likely to happen with the number that get prosecuted versus get declined?
For the record, thank you again. My name is Angie Kemp. I'm a Deputy Attorney General for the Department of Law. Thank you, Chair Klayman. So there's several components to that question. What I can tell you, just consistent with what you've described, that it's a fairly consistent declination rate for typically evidentiary reasons. And mostly when I say evidentiary reasons, it might be there's inadequate corroboration, or there might be something as more nuanced as the statements made by the defendant are inadmissible. So largely that's tends to be the reason for cases or sex offense referrals to be declined. I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of roughly 89%. And that's been a fairly consistent theme since we've started reporting on through sex offense reports. So there's a couple aspects of your question that I want to pick apart just for a moment, if I can. Sex assaults are, I would put them in one bucket, sexual assault in the first and second degree and third degree.
And these are the collection of crimes that we a few years ago changed that, so it's by force and now it's without consent. But those are what we would traditionally describe as rape, where it's where party have to the evidence means showing there's the lack of consent.
Exactly, Chair Klayman. And so that's why I start by saying I put those cases in sort of a unique bucket. And then if you talk separately about sexual abuse of minor and those category of cases, if you're asking me if I think what might naturally follow by raising the age of consent, I think that it might actually become, as it relates to that maybe narrow group of victims, 17 and 16-year-olds, that it would, I'm going to say easier to prosecute, but in some ways easier to prosecute without consent, as you know, tends to be a traditionally difficult burden to bear for the prosecution. And largely that's driven by whether it truly was without consent and the number of factors that we can rely on. And because, as folks naturally may appreciate, these kinds of offenses don't take place typically in the public. So then you're left with, depending upon the circumstances, of course, potentially those situations where you have the victim who's reporting her account or his account of what happened, and then the suspect perhaps saying something different about his account or her account of what happened. So to answer your question, by raising the age of consent, I think that it would provide us more flexibility in our ability to prove offenses. As one person who was testifying, and I'm sorry I didn't catch her name, described, without consent can really be the key difficulty.
Actually, that was one of the questions I was going to ask. I think Ms. Olson described a case involving a young girl in age 16 who apparently there was suggestion of alcohol and possibly drugs involved, and that the observation was that case was not prosecuted as sexual assault, which would have been an option, although at the time not sexual abuse of a minor. Can you provide any insight about why? I mean, does the presence of alcohol and drugs prevent the prosecution from bringing a rape case, or does that incapacitation make it possible to prove lack of consent, even though there may have been a decision not to prosecute that particular case?
Thank you, Chair Klayman. So certainly the introduction of alcohol and drugs to any, if we're talking sexual assault case, becomes a factor that we consider in assessing the strengths and weaknesses, and I think has led to jurors acquitting in sexual assault cases. So sexual, depending upon, for example, if the theory is sexual assault that's based upon the victim's intoxication, whether a jury believes that that victim was so intoxicated as not to appreciate the things that were happening around that person, that's a very, I'll say, subjective analysis and can be a difficulty for a jury. So I do think that the presence of alcohol and drugs potentially can play both ways. So if the person is so intoxicated, by contrast, and there's witnesses that will testify to that, then that certainly can be a compelling factor depending on the theory that we're pursuing.
Okay. I also follow up a little bit on what Representative Gray talked about apparently testimony suggesting that the most common feature about youth involved in sex trafficking is their parents or a parent involvement. Any sense from the Department of Law about whether that's a prevalent statistic in terms of cases you all are investigating today? Because I know this bill does not change the sex trafficking dynamics, I think, in terms of prosecution.
Chair Klayman, no, I'm not prepared to necessarily speak to that one way or the other, just because I can't recall the studies that I reviewed last year well enough to be able to.
Okay.
Answer confidently.
If you could take a look, not today, but if you could take a look at that, because I will be hearing this bill again, and
I can do that.
Would be interested in hearing more. Other questions for Ms. Kemp? All right. Thank you very much. And just for the committee, I'm not sure if everyone on the committee has seen. I've seen it. It's part of the Criminal Justice Data Analysis Commission report. But you all have a copy of the sex offenses report that comes out every year. We will make sure that. That document as well gets loaded up. And I think pretty sure we have it for the last two or three years, so we'll probably load up all the years that we have. All right. I don't see any other questions from committee members. Representative Gray, did you want to add anything else before we adjourn for the day?
Thank you. Chair Klayman, I just wanted to start by apologizing for getting upset earlier. This bill is extremely important to me, and I get a little over emotional, and I just wanted to apologize to you. I am so grateful to you for hearing this bill, and I'm so grateful for the work you did on House Bill 36. I sincerely appreciate all the work you've done. So please forgive me.
I don't think you've done anything needs forgiving, but you're certainly, to the extent you feel I need to forgive you, you are certainly forgiven. I have no concerns with that.
I was speaking from memory about the previous hearings in House Judiciary in years past. I did get a document sent to me that shows that 41% of sex trafficking is familial assisted. So that wouldn't be most. So I need to amend that from my earlier testimony. And I can share, this is from January 2024. This is from DOJ. It is no one can hurt you like
federal,
family. Yes.
Federal Department of Justice.
What we know about familial trafficking. And it is from, it is a federal. It was just sent to me. So I will share that on basis, and it does talk about it does the article itself, which I just skimmed, says that this may be underreported, the familial involvement, but definitely it's a large piece of what we see in sex trafficking. And if I can make one final comment, I know we're going to talk about fiscal notes at a later date. I just wanted to mention that one of the reasons why there has been a lot of changes in the fiscal notes is because when they passed SB 325 in 2022 and Guarantar's House Bill 5 was amended in, which actually changed the definition of consent, there was an assumption of the need for additional monies, and it was approved, and it was never used. And so in House Finance, Deputy Attorney General at the time, John Skidmore, testified about how they had prepared for the need for additional money and didn't need it. And so in part, my goal with the bill, HB 101, is not to prosecute and lock more people up. It's to prevent this crime from happening in the first place. And I know it's very difficult to quantify deterrence. But I strongly believe that folks who are predators on our 16 and 17-year-olds will know when we change that law, and I believe that they will change their target to an older person, not a 16 or 17-year-old, and that is truly the goal behind the bill. Thank you, Chair Klingman.
Representative Gray, I would just note that whether they're 16 or 17 or 18 or 19, the targeting is incredibly troubling to me in all circumstances. But I appreciate your perspective on Department of Law's fiscal notes. I'm sure we will be asking them about those fiscal notes, and I know they know their fiscal notes better than any of us. So I will look forward to hearing their perspective. With that, I don't think we have anything else on our agenda today. Thank you very much for the presentation. We're going to set House Bill 101 aside for further review, and we're going to adjourn for the day. Our next meeting will be on Wednesday, February 11th at 1:30 p.m. We're having a presentation on the Alaska Criminal Justice Data Analysis Commission's 2025 annual report. The presentation made by Suzanne DiPietro, Executive Director of the Alaska Judicial Council, and also the Judicial Council staffs the Criminal Justice Data Analysis Commission. So she'll be with us on Wednesday. We're taking advantage of the fact she's here for the Chief Justice's report that is also coming to a joint session on Wednesday morning. So with that, we're going to adjourn for the day. The time is now 2:13 p.m.